Not yet, I answered. You must not forget that I have just arrived, and do not know where I have to go at present. You will learn all about that as you proceed, she said, as she turned to go. Come with me now. But have I no one to see? Is there no? She saw the perplexity and uncertainty which must have been so plainly visible upon my face, at which she smiled and asked, is it the judgment seat you are looking for? Yes. For at present I know nothing of my position, nor where I must go. Fred, get the earth ideas out of your head as soon as possible. You have already passed the judgment hall, and carry its verdict in the dress you wear. Passed it? Where? I have no knowledge. Perhaps not, but it lies there in those mists from which you see so many coming into the plain, and as she spoke she pointed in the direction to which my attention had been previously called. Is that the way I came? I asked. Yes, that is the only way of entrance into this life. I knew nothing of it, was not conscious of anything until I found myself lying here where we are now standing. That is quite possible, since yours was one of those sudden passages which hurry you so quickly into this state as to leave no consciousness of the event. I often think it is a great blessing to come in such a way. Why? But do I weary you with my questions? No. It will be a pleasure to tell you as much as possible though, as I have not been here so very long, you will have many questions to ask that I cannot answer, and will have to submit them to others who know more than me. I feel that you are just the teacher that I require at present, since all is so different from what I expected. I'm like a child with everything to learn. I shall be glad to tell you what I can, but you must not talk of being tired, for no one wearing our color can grow weary. Wearing our color, I repeated, not knowing what she meant. Yes. You will presently understand that the color of the dress is an indication of the condition of the wearer. But you cannot grasp this until you have seen it for yourself. But tell me why you think it best to enter this life in the manner in which I came? If you will regard the entrance of a soul into this life as birth, rather than death, and the sickness preceding it as a more or less prolonged labor, with a corresponding prostration to follow, you will understand me better. See, she continued, pointing towards the mists, how many have to be assisted, some even carried, into life. How some pause to gain strength to come forward, and tell me, do you not think it preferable to come as you have done? When you consider it in that light, of course it is, but you know we have been taught to look upon it from the other side. That is a great error, which has to be corrected here. Man practically regards the earth life as the chief, rather than the subordinate condition of existence. As a spiritual being, he should be educated to look upon everything from a spiritual standpoint, in the same way as a schoolboy is encouraged to regard his studies in the light of what they will afterwards enable him to accomplish. Earth is not all, neither is it a finality of development, but rather the elementary stage, upon which this is the next advance, while the errors of the lower state have to be uprooted here before we can assume the positions we should be fitted to enter upon on our arrival. This, however, will be more forcibly illustrated for you presently. I am anxious to hear something about that judgment hall. If I came through it unconsciously, as I must have done, how can a righteous sentence be passed upon a man in such a condition? The idea of the judgment hall is another misapprehension owing to the literal interpretation of what was only intended as a parabolic metaphor. Do you mean that I have no knowledge of it, for the simple reason that no such place exists? I asked. So far as there being a regular trial and sentence by a personal judge, it is a fiction. The verdict of the bar of God is more just and unerring than that could be, and asks no evidence other than the defendant offers. The text which hung above my bed in the hospital is the law upon which the judgment is given, and from which no appeal is asked or granted. Be not deceived, God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man soweth that shall he also reap. Justice cannot miscarry, since no man is called to give evidence against his fellow. As the soul comes into contact with those mists, it separates from the flesh, and is stripped of any false and seeming character, which may have been assumed, no matter under what circumstances or for what purpose. The function of the mists is to dissolve everything but the spiritual. There all the seals of life are broken, Everything which has been hidden is revealed, the books are opened wide, whether to acquit or to condemn. It would be just as rational to expect a builder to say, as he put the final touches to a cottage, that ought to have been a cathedral, and I believe it is, or for a farmer to say to his men, that field of turnips should have been wheat, and I believe it is, go and reap it, and find their belief honored in the transformation, as for a man, when he feels the chill of dissolution upon him, to think that by the acceptance of any creed or system of belief, he can, in that moment of fear, eradicate the evils of the life, time, and receive an abundant entrance into everlasting joy. No, Fred. As the mortal drops away, there is evolved from the spirit a natural covering in accordance with its life and character, the color being determined by the acts and motives of the past, not by the creeds it has held or the professions it has made, and that color is the righteous sentence which the soul has passed upon itself by virtue of the invariable law of God. Then you subordinate faith to works? Works are to faith precisely what the spirit is to the body, the life. Faith without works is dead, therefore faith can only be manifested by works. The teaching of Jesus is, inasmuch as ye did it, not believed it, and nothing but love and noble deeds are able to enter this life in company with the soul, all forms of belief are lost in yonder mists. Who then can be saved? We hope that every individual child will be, ultimately, and I think if one shall be accepted it will be his own fault entirely. Why so? Because that judgment is not final, it only determines what position the soul must assume on entering this life, it has still the power to elevate itself as well as the assistance of others who are always working to raise those in the conditions beneath them. Thus the sentence is not for eternity and vindictive, it is probationary and remedial. Why, Helen, do you mean to say there is no hell? Not by any means, we have hells of torment far worse than your imagination can picture, but they are only purifying conditions and have been provided in the fullness of our Father's love, as you will presently be made to understand. I have been fortunate in finding such a teacher to correct my ignorance, I said. Before I saw you I felt like a child at school whose education had been sadly neglected, but now, it seems that all I know is wrong, and has to be uprooted. You will find that full provision has been made for all corrections as you proceed, she answered. And knowledge is easily acquired by those who wish to learn. It is an active life upon which you enter. Every person capable of work has some appointed mission, so that we are all workers together with God. My place for the present is here, to meet those who have just arrived, so I have been especially instructed in such matters as are first inquired into. If the verdict is given upon works alone, who are they who receive the abundant entrance promised so liberally to believers? I asked. In that judgment, she answered, every act, motive, and attendant circumstance in the life of a man is its legitimate consideration, and is appraised at its sterling value, and the balance struck accordingly. Acts of charity originating in expediency are gauged by the attainment of the object desired, and leave no balance to the life's account. Munificent philanthropy bestowed for political or selfish purposes is recompensed by the approbation it received, the building and endowment of a hospital or church by wealth amassed in the drink or such like traffic, is counterbalanced by the shattered lives and ruined homes of its many victims. Self, sacrificing love, to relieve pain, distress and want, not done to be seen of men, but from sympathy with the weak and unfortunate brother, the motive which prompts a man to give what he himself may need, to lessen the sufferings of another, the patient endurance of wrong until the father determines to avenge, the charity which rises to the defense of the weak against the strong, at the expense of obloquy and shame, the heart which refuses to condemn when appearances are black because the whole circumstances are not known, the man who, when injured, steps in to break the blow of justice because he too would wish to be forgiven. These are they who, in that judgment, lift up their heads and hear, well done. This makes all men equal in their advantages and adds commensurate responsibility where wealth or power has been entrusted. Would you teach men to repudiate wealth? I asked. Certainly not, but we would teach them that every gift is only held in stewardship, and that they will be called upon to render an account in the mists. Our Father has placed upon earth enough to supply the needs and give some comforts to every one of his children, but the strong have taken away the portion of the weak, until luxury and starvation abounds. Is this right? No. And at the judgment, the plea that the wealth so held was honorably acquired will not avail, since God designs that it must also be lovingly dispensed. Take one such man, who, having made division of his wealth among his children, saw the elder taking the portion of the younger son away. Think you that father would be willing to complacently allow the wrong? Shall God be less just than we demand a man should be? Of course not. The bond of brotherhood is more powerful than legal right in the sight of God, and the verdict of his court is given in accordance with family responsibility, not mercantile law. Suppose one was anxious to carry out a good work but pressure of circumstances prevented. How would that be regarded? That will be more ably explained to you by others presently, but in the meantime I can partially answer it by telling you of one of the first receptions I attended after my arrival. Do you hold receptions then in heaven? Yes. Though they are somewhat different to yours. When any friends go across the boundary to bring a pilgrim home, we call it a reception. That I refer to was one of those abundant entrances you speak of, and Imra went to welcome the brother. Who is Imra? The governor of this state, and the highest spirit I have seen except Jesus. Have you seen him, Helen? Yes, once, but he was at a distance from me, so I did not speak to him. But to tell you of this reception, the man we went to meet was an inmate of a workhouse, but there were thousands of spirits present to receive him. From a workhouse? Yes. I shall never forget the scene. When Imra drew near to the bed, the closing eyes caught a sight of him, and the coming saint cried to his friend, who was asleep on a chair beside him, John, John. I am going now, someone has come for me. John. Don't you see how light the room is? See, the angels, and, no. Not Jesus. Not for me. Then the poor feeble frame, which had half risen in his excitement, fell back, and the watcher found it cold when he awoke, for the spirit had dropped its veil of flesh. As the soul came away, Imra threw his arm around him, and bade him welcome. Then, with a bewildered, almost frightened look, the man gazed upon the host that crowded round him, and, turning to Imra, stammered, "This is not for me. It is a mistake. You did not come for me?" "Yes, we did, my brother," replied Imra. "We do not make mistakes, they are all behind you now. But, it cannot be for me. I have not been a good man. My lord, it must be a mistake. What have I done? Fed the hungry, clothed the naked, and ministered to the sick," Imra replied. "Ah! Now I know you are wrong. I have been almost all my life in the workhouse. I never had any money to do it at all. I knowed it warn't for me. You once gave your dinner to a hungry lad," said Imra. "You gave a pair of boots, you could badly spare, to a wandering tramp. You gave your glasses to a poor old woman who could not see to read, and left yourself in the same condition. You sat beside an old comrade when he was ill, and nursed him back to health. You have been patient in your enforced poverty, and encouraged others to hope for the best and be contented. Have you not?" "Well, yes, I did sit beside old Bill, a bit, but he'd have done the same for me, if I'd have wanted it. I don't know much about the rest. But we do, such deeds are never forgotten with us, and there are many things you wished to do if you had but had the power. Such honest will is always accepted by God as if the deed had been successfully performed, and so, you see, we are not wrong." By this time he had been carried some distance from his body, and had assumed his new robes, in which he was triumphantly escorted to one of the many mansions prepared for such as he. "What a surprise for him," I remarked, as she concluded. "Why, it must have been as great as my own. But where are these homes you speak of?" "I have not seen anything in the shape of a building yet. They are over the crest of the hill. Have you not been to the top?" "No." "Come then, let us go. That will enable you to turn your back on the mists, and I will show you the country in another direction." Chapter 3. A Prismatic Landscape. I am not, or was not in the other life, an enthusiast. No person, however imaginative they might have been, would have used such a word in the delineation of my character. Cold, dull, unimpassioned, prosaic, phlegmatic, even stupid, would have been considered appropriate epithets by many, but enthusiastic, never. Such a spirit is born of lively imagination and appreciation, but I had not the one, and was constantly assured I knew nothing of the other. How, then, could I be enthusiastic? This was undoubtedly true of the old life, but does that justify me in saying it is equally so in this? Is the change in character and temperament so slight? Are we so much of our old selves, merely translated into new fields and surroundings, that everything which was true in the past is equally true of the present? These were questions which instinctively rose to my mind, but I had not the power or knowledge to answer them. That some changes had taken place I was fully conscious, though whether they were permanent or otherwise I had no means of ascertaining for the present. Further experience might show they were prompted for the moment by the strange circumstances crowding upon me. For instance, I was by no means inquisitive in the past, but since I had found myself here I had done nothing but ask, how, when, whence, or why. From myself and the only two friends I had had the opportunity to speak to. This undertone of speculation was running through my mind, while my more active senses were delighting in the magnificence of the view I beheld on reaching the summit of the slope. Being quite happy in my original position, and having still a multitude of questions to ask, I was not in the least degree desirous of moving, even though I had been told of the greater beauties of the country I could so easily reach. When Helen made the suggestion, if the choice had been left to me I should have deferred our departure, or, what is more probable, moved in the other direction, towards the mists. She seemed perfectly to understand my desire, and said, it is quite natural you should wish to go that way, but it would not be well for you at present. Why? I asked. The influences being somewhat unpleasant just now, she replied, you would find it difficult to return. When the attraction is broken there will be no objection to your going to watch the new arrivals. What attraction? I asked. The attraction of your body. When the dissolution takes place so suddenly, as in your case, the magnetic link is not completely severed for a short time, and the soul feels an almost irresistible desire to go back towards the body. The same experience is common to friends still in the body. Full many a time they say dash good. Bye. Yet still they linger at the door, and when they tear themselves apart love cries dash come back one moment more. It was to break this influence and set you free that I asked you at first to come home with me. It was too strong upon you then, but now you can accomplish it, so we will go. Do all these who are lying here feel that attraction? I asked. Yes, but they are induced to leave as soon as possible. I see some are not detained at all. No. They have grown weary of the body, and readily part with it, so have nothing to hinder their going to their homes at once. How long does the attraction usually last? It varies considerably, as frequently circumstances over which the soul has no control, are exercised to prevent the desired freedom. For instance, many are held in restraint by grief of friends long after the influence of the body has been overcome. How can that be? I have told you that love is the greatest power we know. Of this the soul is conscious so soon as it leaves the body, and the perturbation of friends has therefore a sympathetic attraction, too strong for its resistance. It forms an anchor which binds the spirit to the earth. Sometimes we have much difficulty in counteracting the pernicious influences of grief, which love would certainly prompt the bereaved ones to restrain if they could but once be made to witness the effect it produces. But is not the spirit compelled to come away? No. We use no force in this life under any circumstances. Every person retains the use of his free will, the exercise of which invariably produces its own reward or punishment. Well. The old life has not many attractions for me, and I have no desire to renew it upon the same terms, so we will do as you desire, go forward. We reached the summit of the slope, and I stood entranced by the scene which lay before me. From the foot of a gentle declivity, clothed in grass of the richest, softest green I had ever beheld, a landscape stretched away on every side dressed in more, shades of color than I had power to estimate. I had gazed upon the skies of Italy, beautiful and calm, but the cloudless grandeur of their star, illumined glories, was like the cold placidity of death, bound sleep, in contrast with the infinite and vaulted dome of eternal energy beneath which I stood, involuntarily bowing before the baptism of life with which it bathed me. I had seen the magnificence of some oriental landscapes, with the radiance of a legion colors thrown in rich mosaics all around, but it were profanation to compare such hues and shades and tints with these before my eyes. Pulsations of visible vitality throbbed and trembled in stone and tree and flower, each of which poured forth its rhythmic quota to the harmonic proclamation which sounded from every side that death is swallowed up in victory, and over the threshold of the future, reaching to the horizon of either pole. The legend ran, "Life, life, eternal life." But why attempt the impossible? Words never yet were able to convey an adequate idea of many scenes on earth. How then can they be used to tell the greater glories which the language of the soul has not the power to paint, but leaves the entranced beholder to understand by silent comprehension? O, hearts! The milestones of whose pilgrimage are lettered alternately with battle, defeat, and failure, ye outcast wayfarers, ostracized from all that once was dear, ye who are hungering for a look of sympathy, thirsting for a kindly word, groping for one ray of hope, ye crushed and mangled, maimed and tortured on a rack of social propriety, ye banned and banished from a soulless church, because your weary feet have stumbled by the way, ye martyrs to the greed for wealth, and fame, and power, ye, weary of life's struggle, all, yea, whosoever will sink down to sleep, and in the wild delirium of your dreams, give rein to all your fantasies, let your imagination conjure before you all you wish for or would dare to crave, picture to yourselves all you think of heaven, revel among the anticipations of what you there would find, then multiply the product yet a thousand times, and grasp the concept, if you can. But even though you reach the height of this desire, you will not have caught more than a faint reflection of the provision made for the enjoyment of the righteous when their blood-stained feet have reached the goal of heaven. From the foot of the hill on which I stood, 100 paths diverged to every part of the landscape, not the monotonous prosaic roads to which earth is so accustomed, but every one had, not a name, but a distinctive color corresponding with the city or district to which it led. They were arranged so that the darker shades curved themselves on either hand in the foreground, each having a greater or less depression according to its tone, until I lost them as they sank beneath my feet. The lighter tints appeared to have a corresponding elevation, until in the center of the prospect lay one straight line of faultless white leading to an arc of brilliant purity in the far distance. Helen left me for a time that I might gaze on the sight undisturbed, and when she returned was accompanied by several friends more or less intimately known to me. We sat down and talked over the events of our past lives, and speculated upon our future prospects with a feeling of restful satisfaction and enjoyment to which I had hitherto been a stranger. Each individual seemed in some inexplicable manner to add to my sense of gladness, and even now when I know so much more of their life than new to me, I look back upon that reunion as one of the sweetest recollections of spirit experience. You can begin to understand the significance of the colored dresses now, Helen said, during a pause in our conversation. Yes. I perceive that each person takes the road corresponding in color to the dress he wears. But who are those in party, colored robes, a combination of pink with electric blue? They are messengers or teachers. It was Erasmus, one of their number, who attended you at the time of your accident, and brought you to the place where I found you. See, that is he, coming to take you away and teach you more than I am able to. He was a Greek, and beautiful as an Apollo. Though I had no consciousness of having seen him before, his smile of welcome and recognition forbade the idea that we were strangers. As I rose, he caught me in a brother's embrace, and held me closely to him, without one word to break the hallowed silence of his greeting. Are you rested now? He asked at length. Yes, I answered, but so bewildered. That is by no means an uncommon experience. The revelations that await the soul on arrival here are calculated to overpower until you have been taught the simple key by which everything is solved. Who will teach me this grand art of solution? I asked. I will, if you desire to know it. When? Now if you wish, who would not wish to learn so great a secret? My soul is hungering for such knowledge. What is the mighty power? Love. He replied. This life in all its phases, its multiform developments, its heights and depths, is but a grand commentary on that one word. Love is the only study we pursue, the food we eat, the life we live, and it is to participate in joys of this inexhaustible knowledge that you are now invited, and Mahanian asks me to introduce you to such features of it as I am capable of. Who is Mahanian? I asked. One of the messengers or teachers between this and the next stage of life, who acts as ruler of several cities or circles in this state. But is not God the ruler? He is the supreme, King of kings, and Lord of lords, but under him are many subordinates, cherubim, seraphim, archangels, ruling over the different dominions and divisions of this life, and Mahanian is one of the lowest authorities. That is another piece of surprising information, I said. So I anticipated, he replied. Though it ought not to be, for the fact has been clearly revealed to man, but darkness has covered the earth, and gross darkness the people, who in their ignorance have wandered from the way and are lost in the wilderness of doubt, confusion and error. And where does the root of this error lie, as seen from this life? In the doctrine that the soul has to make its eternal and final choice on earth, rather than that being the elementary stage of its unending development. The legitimate duty of earth is to ground the soul in the practical principles of love, in order to fit it for its entrance upon the higher duties of this estate. Abstract speculations in theology are not the studies man is called upon to undertake, especially when his teachers work upon indefinite theories, and have no absolute knowledge. Even here we are not competent to speak upon many matters our brethren in the flesh have settled to their own satisfaction. But we must wait until we reach those conditions in which the necessary faculties will be developed to understand the present mysteries. Advanced instruction in science is not given by pupil teachers to the scholars in an infant class, and our father knows the requirements and capacities of his children better than to have so designed the course of their spiritual education. I notice how you appeal to reason in all your illustrations, I said, being anxious to hear his opinion about it. Undoubtedly, he replied. All laws have their root and center in God, and are therefore capable of being reasoned upon so far as we can comprehend them. The so-called natural laws are spiritual laws translated into requisite expressions for physical existence, and, if rightly understood, would serve as an index to spiritual progress. The struggle for supremacy of greed and influence has, unfortunately, resulted in exalting the letter of the law, while the spirit of its revelation has been ignored, hence the rise of error and misconception. Take for instance the present orthodox idea of heaven. Suppose at the mists a harp was thrust into every unskilled hand, while every unmusical voice commenced an unending shout of glory, glory, glory. Well, it might be their ideal of heaven, but what would be the opinion of such as Handel, Mozart, Beethoven, and the thousands of others who understand the laws of harmony? One moment's serious thought would make it impossible for such an idea to remain as true. Perhaps so. But I am unable to see how it would be possible for them to form an accurate conception of this life. It is so different from what I expected to find it, and I was no friend of orthodoxy. Why is it so different? Not because it is unreal, but that you have formed an unnatural opinion of it. The change from mortality to immortality is but a stage in the development of the soul, similar to that which changes the blossom to the fruit. The natural law is not broken and destroyed in either case, it is but carried forward another stage towards the object to be achieved. You never find the blossom of the sloe to be the progenitor of a beech, or the bud of a daisy to expand into a rose. So in the translation from the lower life to this, precisely the same law is in operation, this being the complement and continuation of that. But it becomes such an occasion of bewilderment from the fact that man is erroneously taught to believe that, by a simple act of faith, Exercised even in the hour of dissolution, he has the power to accomplish such an impossibility in the case of his soul, which, you say, would be insane to suggest in relation to the fruit or the flower.